again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. And I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, the center's other co-director, Mark DiGirolami, for an episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived at our website, lawandreligionforum.org, or also on Apple iTunes. Well, today, Mark, we're going to talk about a new cert grant in what is potentially an extremely important case for free exercise that's going to be argued next term at the Supreme Court. So after a period of relative quiet, the Roberts Court has really taken a number of important cases this term and next term. This term, we have the Espinoza case that we've talked about already, and also Beal. And now, next term, the court is going to be hearing Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, which really could shake things up dramatically for the free exercise clause. So in this podcast, we're going to talk about the facts of the case and the Third Circuit opinion below. Then we're going to talk about the issues on appeal. And finally, we're going to reflect on the larger context here, because I do think, Mark, and we'll discuss this, that it looks like this could be a really significant case for the court and for free exercise jurisprudence. So, Mark, why don't you start us off with the facts of the case?
Okay, terrific. And I totally agree. This is a case that has a potential to be absolutely huge with respect to free exercise jurisprudence. Or on the other hand, it could be a complete dud. So we'll have to see what happens. But here are the facts. So the case is about Catholic Social Services, which is an organization that provides foster care services and that is part of the ministry of the Archdiocese, the Catholic Archdiocese of Philadelphia. This organization does a number of charitable works, but other charitable works besides foster care placement. But this is something that CSS, I'll call it for short, has been doing for more than a century. In fact, well before the city itself became involved in foster care. They're about, this is one of about 30 agencies in the city of Philadelphia that now do this. But CSS is one of the oldest ones. And so,
and as I understand it, Mark, there are these agencies actually specialize in different communities and different interests. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the way that this works is that families that are interested in fostering reach out to one of these agencies. And different agencies specialize in different communities with different interests and different ways of doing things and different ways of life. For example, some agencies will specialize in serving the Latino community, and some will focus on disabled children or special needs children, and some will serve the LGBT community. So they all have their various focus areas. And if an agency, for whatever reason, isn't able to serve a particular family, the standard practice, although this is apparently a point of contention in the legal materials, but the standard practice is to refer that family to a different agency that is able to serve the family's needs. So if it thinks it is able to do so, then there's if the agency says, okay, this might be a good fit, then there's a further investigation of the living situation with the specific family involved, and then a certification to the city that the agency authorizes the placement.
Right, and then there's some money involved, Mark?
There's some money involved, right? It's not a lot, but there is some. The city actually is, at this point, has the ultimate decision whether to make the placement, and if it does decide to do so, then it pays these organizations a fee for each child that they place. You know, these are, by and large, Mark, nonprofit organizations. So it's not like they're in this for the money. In fact, most of the money goes to the foster parents where the child has been placed. But there is a little bit of money that goes to the nonprofit as well.
Okay. So as I understand it, what happened here is CSS got in trouble with the city of Philadelphia because it has a policy as a matter of religious conviction. It will not serve families or authorize placements with unmarried heterosexual couples or also same-sex couples. I guess in theory, it would refer those cases to other agencies, although apparently there's no record of any parents in those categories ever having approached CSS for placement. Is that right?
That's right. That's my understanding as well. And so what happened was that in 2018, the Philadelphia City Council and the mayor of Philadelphia begin an investigation of CSS. And I think, Mark, the way that this happened was this was after some kind of news story or media investigation of CSS. It came to light that it had these policies, and then an official government investigation begins of CSS. And the investigation really focuses on religious agencies, CSS especially, and the referrals that those agencies authorized. And the result of this investigation is that CSS is informed by the commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Human Services that, quote unquote, times have changed and, quote unquote, it's not 100 years ago, and that CSS should, quote, follow the teachings of Pope Francis, close quote, and change its policies. So it's informed in this sort of in this meeting that it has with this administrator that this is the administrator's views.
Right. And then subsequently, the city cuts off CSS's foster care referrals. Now, the city actually has some other explanations for why it did that, although we should note that the petitioners claim that this is one of the claims in the case, that all these explanations are, in fact, pretextual and post hoc. But one explanation the city gave was that they were cutting off CSS because CSS violated a city ordinance that forbids discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, among other things, in public accommodations.
Yeah, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, which is, I think, actually an important one for these purposes also, and other categories in public accommodation. So I think, Mark, that is the that's the sort of primary legal argument advanced by the city. There are other ones that we'll talk about in a second, but my sense from the briefing is that that's the big one.
Right.
And CSS responds and it says, look, I mean, the problem here is that foster care has never been thought of as a public accommodation before. This is a public accommodations statute. And in fact, state law requires foster agencies to consider things like marital status in deciding where to place. I mean, how could it not, right? I mean, you're trying to find a relatively stable place for a child. You have to consider the family situation in all of its complexity when you are determining where a child. You can't be oblivious to that entirely, quite apart from the specific decisions that you make about which kind of family situation is best.
Yeah, well, although I guess maybe that's something that City of Philadelphia might change in the future, who knows. And then there are some other explanations that were given about contractual provisions, and then there's a city charter provision about non-discrimination, although as you say, that those seem to be somewhat less important than the first one, than, you know, this is a public accommodation. And although that's disputed too, whether this is a public accommodation, but that it's a non-discrimination provision in the city ordinance.
Yeah, so I think that there's the city ordinance claim. There are various contractual claims. I think the city ended up changing the contract a number of times afterward. This is in part why CSS says that this is pretextual. Apparently, it points to a no referrals clause in the contract, even though, as we've mentioned, the practice seems to have been to make referrals all the time, although not in CSS's case with respect to some of these issues that we've been talking about, because people knew better, it seems to me, than to come to CSS for those kinds of services. At any rate, those are subsidiary, in my view at least, subsidiary sorts of claims.
Well, of course, and the petitioners say, maybe with some justification, this is just a strategy by the city to make this into a very fact-specific case, which the court might try to get rid of because it's just so complicated. It doesn't seem to have worked so far. Okay, well, so CSS lost below, and especially in the Third Circuit, they lost. It was a unanimous opinion in the Third Circuit, actually. So, Mark, what did the Third Circuit say here?
Yeah, they lost at the district court. They lost at the Third Circuit level. The Third Circuit says, look, that we reject CSS's claim that it had been targeted by the city for religious reasons. It described the comments by the city administrator about Pope Francis and the other stuff as, quote, an effort to achieve common ground by appealing to an authority within their shared religious tradition. And ultimately, look, I mean, Philadelphia said, the court said that Philadelphia was enforcing a neutral and generally applicable non-discrimination policy, right? That's the really the first ground that we talked about. And the court said that can't trigger any free exercise clause concerns under Employment Division versus Smith, which is this important case that we've talked about many times on our podcast, Mark, which the rule of which for those listeners who are new says that if you've got a neutral law of general applicability, even if that law has the effect of unduly burdening burdening, even substantially burdening a religious exercise, that's not going to be good enough to get a free exercise clause claim.
Okay, so now we're up at the Supreme Court, and the petition which was granted, the petition for cert, raises three claims. So the first of these claims has to do with what you just said, whether the Philadelphia ordinance is neutral and generally applicable such that a religious accommodation would not be required under the free exercise clause under this case called Employment Division versus Smith. Now, this particular claim, Mark, strikes me as a kind of narrow claim that is not exceptionally important, but why don't you tell me what you think about it?
Yeah, so this is one of these classic, I agree with what you just said, it's one of these classic sort of circuit split claims. It's the kind of thing that you tell law students that they're supposed to find in order to write a plausible note. And that's exactly what the petition does. It says, look, you've got two circuits, the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, that require a free exercise clause plaintiff to show that it was treated more harshly than the government would have treated someone who engaged in the same conduct but had different religious views. Mm-hmm. So basically, these circuits require free exercise clause plaintiffs to show that the government would allow the same conduct by somebody who held different religious positions. So, for example, another religious group that also refused to work with same-sex couples or non-married heterosexual couples, but as to which an exemption from the law was granted, mm-hmm, on the basis of their religious beliefs. Otherwise, if you can't show that, these two circuits say, then a law that is neutral and generally applicable is going to survive. So that's on one side. On the other side, the majority of circuits allow a free exercise plaintiff to show that a law is not neutrally and generally applicable by showing other sorts of, by recourse to other kinds of evidence. For example, that the government grants individualized exemptions to other sorts of claimants, or that the law exempts secular conduct that undermines whatever the government says is the compelling interest, but it doesn't allow exemptions for religious conduct.
Right, Mark. And I think that second interpretation is the majority interpretation of what is meant by neutral and generally applicable. It's not meant to distinguish between different religions. It's meant to distinguish between religion and non-religion, I think.
Well, you know, what's funny about this, Mark, is I seem to remember various, at least a couple of opinions by Justice Alito when he was on the Third Circuit, when he was, mm-hmm, a judge on the Third Circuit, that apply a very different approach than what the Third Circuit is said to apply. Now, look, it might be that since Justice Alito was on the court, the Third Circuit has gone in a different direction with respect to their free exercise clause. I just don't know. But it did strike me that's a quite different approach than some of these relatively famous cases that then Judge Alito decided.
Okay, so one issue before the court is how we define neutral and generally applicable. That's one. And I said it was kind of a narrow issue, but only in comparison to the second claim, which really is a very broad claim.
Yeah.
Because in the second claim, the petitioners are saying that the Supreme Court should actually revisit and, let's face it, overrule the Smith decision.
That's right. It says, you know, as a good petition must, it says, look, there's lots of confusion that Smith has generated in the lower courts, and the Supreme Court has been steadily narrowing Smith, petitioners say, first in the Lukumi case, which was decided a couple of years after Smith, then in Hosanna-Tabor, which the court actually, my memory is right, the court tried to distinguish Smith Whether it did so successfully or not is another question, but it did try. Then in Trinity Lutheran, the case about, you know, playground resurfacing grants. Then in Masterpiece Cake Shop. So what the petition tries to do is to argue that over the span of the last 30 years, every decision that the court has made concerning free exercise has been essentially a narrowing of Smith. And that, says the petition, that has caused confusion, right? So Smith was meant to be this clear and easily administrable rule, and it hasn't been that. It's been a mess. It's been a mess in part because perhaps some mechanics internal to Smith, but also because of the way that the court has kind of steadily, gradually but steadily moved away.
So the petitioners are saying, let's get rid of Smith, I think. Now, we should say that they are following the invitation of Justice Alito and three other justices last year in a case called Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, in which Justice Alito and his three colleagues said, look, maybe it's time to revisit Smith. And of course, if Smith is overruled, that would likely mean a return to the compelling interest test, which says that under the Free Exercise Clause, a state cannot substantially burden a person's religious exercise unless the state has a compelling interest for doing so, and also the state has chosen the least restrictive means of doing so. So to overrule Smith, which is what the petitioners are suggesting here, really would be a serious change.
Oh, it would be huge. I mean, it would be right. Really, really big. I mean, so the difference between in scope between the first claim and the second claim is enormous. And actually, it's funny, if you look at the petition itself, you know, there's the first claim that the petitioners spend a lot of time making that claim and showing that there are these different ways in which Smith has been interpreted. The second claim, it's funny, to their credit, they say, hey, you know, how about taking a look at this again? Because as a petitioner, you know, I have to imagine it's difficult to basically ask the court to overrule a decision. That's not normally the way these things go.
Yes, difficult. But as I said, in that Kennedy statement, in the statement in the Kennedy case, Justice Alito kind of said, we're thinking about doing this. So, I mean, he was clearly hinting.
And by the way, listeners, we have a whole podcast on the
case.
So if you're interested in what that case was about, go back, listen. We've got a nice nifty little archive tool that our good librarians have put together for us at St. John's. You can use it. You can go back to any podcast you want with great ease and listen.
Okay. And the third claim is actually a free speech claim involving a doctrine that we've talked about before called unconstitutional conditions. And the idea is that the state cannot place conditions on, it's usually funding. Here, I guess it would be participation in a program. The state cannot put conditions on funding or participation that would have the effect of forcing a denial of constitutional rights.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a kind of one of these classic leverage sorts of claims, right? By imposing a kind of licensing requirement in a way that would violate CSS's freedom of speech, the city is violating this doctrine, this unconstitutional conditions doctrine. And here, actually, the unconstitutional conditions doctrine is complicated. There are lots mm-hmm. of wrinkles. A lot of people who are even experts say it's not clear from case to case how it gets applied. But it seems to me here, because the plaintiffs are not otherwise free to engage in the activity of foster care placement, that is, they can't do it at all if they decline the terms of the city's terms, petitioners say, we don't have a choice. We can't just decline the city funding and pay for the foster work ourselves. This is a nonprofit. So the issue of choice, they say, is a kind of hallmark. It's an important feature of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which arguably moves the needle in their direction.
Okay, so these are the claims the petitioners are making. Now, at the beginning of the podcast, we said that this could be a real blockbuster case. So let's talk about some of the big picture items here, about why we think this could be so important. To my mind, Mark, it looks like the court has granted this case in order to address a question that it predicted back in Obergefell when it held that same-sex marriage is a constitutionally protected right. That is, what happens to those religious groups that continue to oppose same-sex marriage? Will they be allowed to participate in public programs as before, or will they now have to accept significant restrictions? In other words, is it possible to have a live and let live world after Obergefell? And that's, I think, what makes this case important. Now, you said it might be a dud. So why do you think it might be a dud and not a really important case?
Well, it might be narrow in light of the expressions of anti-religious hostility or snarkiness or something by the government official, where the court might say, look, just that in of itself is a kind of targeting, is a
right.
violation of the free exercise clause.
Right. So what you're talking about here, Mark, is this case called Masterpiece Cake Shop, in which this is the baker who didn't want to bake the cake for the same-sex wedding. And the officials adjudicating his case, one of them made a remark about how despicable the religious views were in that case. Here, it's not like the officials actually said Catholic social services was despicable. They said something, you know, go listen to Pope Francis, get with the times. These are a little more ambiguous, I think, than the remarks in Masterpiece Cake Shop. They're more, you said, snarky, more sort of sarcastic and perhaps ill-informed than hostile.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right about that. I would want to say just one point about the issue raised about the Obergefell language and what's going to happen to all of these objecting. It seems to me that Masterpiece is a You could imagine Masterpieces in that line, is in the what's going to happen after Obergefell line. And so the first step in that line is what the court took to be overt hostility, right? Which in the commissioners there, the administrator's statements, I think it was a tribunal, somebody was, you know, one of these civil rights commissions, they were really hostile and sort of angry. You might see this as in that same line also. And if I take your point to be that if the court goes in this direction, it's kind of, it would be expanding the scope of what counts as hostility.
Correct.
So that might be a way to, you know, a kind of new set of doctrines explaining what happens after Obergefell.
Yeah, that's true. So that's one way it could go. There are reasons to think the court won't take that approach, though. And if the court doesn't take that approach, if it doesn't limit it to the facts of this case, you know, the comments in the case, well, then this really will be very important. Because to my mind, if the court agrees with even one of petitioner's three claims, then the court really will have to determine how to balance two principles, the anti-discrimination principle, here with respect to LGBT persons, and religious freedoms. Let's just go through this, right? If this is not, the Philadelphia Ordinance is not a neutral and generally applicable law, well, then the court will have to apply strict scrutiny. If Smith is overruled, the court will have to apply strict scrutiny. And if this is an unconstitutional condition, the court will have to apply strict scrutiny. And that means what?
Just jump in on one point. So one ambiguity that we've talked about before is, when is the question whether when you have targeting, whether the law is just sort of categorically unconstitutional at that point? That seems to be sort of what the court, you know, it with Kennedy and Masterpiece said, or whether you then apply strict scrutiny. It isn't clear to me that the court has decided that question conclusively yet, but either way, it's either strict scrutiny or an automatic holding of unconstitutionality.
Correct. Yeah? So we don't really know. I think it means strict scrutiny, but you're right. After Masterpiece Cake Shop, it's not clear. Now, if strict scrutiny is going to be applied here, that means that's the compelling interest test. The law can be upheld only if the state shows a compelling interest in applying the law to the person and the state has chosen the least restrictive means. So here we'd ask, does the state have a compelling interest in applying laws that bar discrimination against LGBT families to this particular adoption agency, and has the state chosen the least restrictive means of doing so? So, you know, this might force the court to address a question that it really has tried to avoid, at least since the Bob Jones University case, which involved race, not LGBT persons. That is, how do we measure the state's interest in ending discrimination against minorities with the constitutional commitment to the free exercise of religion? Court really has tried to avoid this, but I don't see how the court can avoid it if it goes down the path in this case.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I mean, it's been and as you say, this is one of the issues that's been left hanging after Obergefell. It was adverted to by all of the many of the dissents in Obergefell, and maybe this will be the first case that where it deals with this question, right? So in Hobby Lobby, we had a kind of an analogous thing going on, but of course we weren't dealing with nonprofits in Hobby Lobby, which we're dealing with here. So in some ways, this plaintiff is an especially attractive plaintiff if the court wanted to start giving us some doctrine about exactly how to manage these two conflicting values.
Right. Now, in Hobby Lobby, the court said, look, there, we'll take it as, for the purposes of argument, we'll accept there's a compelling interest in women's reproductive health, broadly speaking. But they said the compelling interest test was not satisfied there. Now, here, the court might say, even assuming that the state has a compelling interest generally in preventing discrimination against LGBT persons, it doesn't have an interest with respect to this agency in particular, because there are other adoption agencies in Philadelphia that will place kids with LGBT families. So there's not a compelling interest in forcing CSS to do it. Now, if the court does that, I mean, look, the court would never say that, would never make such a claim with respect to race. We wouldn't say that an adoption agency could discriminate on the basis of race, because there are other adoption agencies that don't discriminate on the basis of race. So if the court goes down this path, that might require the court to distinguish between racial minorities and other minorities, which is another step that the court might not wish to take, Mark.
I think you're right about that. And I'm not sure. I mean, if the case goes big in that kind of direction, then I think the court is going to be forced to take on a lot of questions that, at least to date, you know, the Roberts Court, it's tended to be pretty small steps across the entire constitutional canon, but certainly in the religion clause area. You know, we've talked about, you know, in previous cases, oh, maybe this will be the one, Mark, right? Maybe this will be the big one, right? Lemon's going to be overruled, whether it's the establishment clause, or maybe this is going to be the, and they never seem to be, right? They never seem to come to pass. And so there we are, sort of, you know, making these bold predictions, and it's always just one little factual distinction after another in these cases. Which, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know how you feel. It's a little frustrating, actually, for me. I mean, I understand the allure and the virtues of minimalism, but I also think, you know, we've been doing this for, you know, 3 or 4 years now, and I guess 3 years with respect to podcasts, and longer, haven't we? Maybe 2 years. 2 years for podcasts. So, but at any rate, it feels like we're constantly making these bold predictions and they're never coming true.
Okay, well, I just want to say, with regard to the establishment clauses, I remember it. I wasn't predicting anything big in that case, Mark. So I just want, I don't want to get into a fight here.
Fair enough.
But I don't think I was. In this case, though, look, it seems to me they've taken this case to overrule the Third Circuit. I don't think they're going to affirm the Third Circuit here. And I'm not sure how they're going to get out of a big case. Maybe in the way you're saying, Mark, maybe they'll say this is, you know, they'll say these comments by the city commissioner were just over the line, and then we don't have to go any further. We'll have to see. So look, listeners, we're gonna wait and see what the merits briefs say, and then of course we'll see what oral argument is next term, and then maybe Mark will be in more of a good position to predict exactly how the court is going to resolve these questions. So for now, listeners, this has been another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes at lawandreligionforum.org and also on Apple iTunes. So see you next time.